Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we begin on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, IPO talks swirl around Channel Advisor. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Morrisville. And along with this article that runs horizontally across the top of the page, at the far left, there's a picture of a man standing in front of a computer. And the caption reads, Channel Advisor CEO Scott Wingo wants global growth. Channel Advisor, a poster child of sorts for the region's technology sector, may be plotting a course to become the next Red Hat or Cree, as reports surface that the company has hired Goldman Sachs and Stifel Nicolaus to show it the way to a public offering of stock. But challenges remain for the e-commerce software company. CEO Scott Wingo had no comment on a Reuters report that the company is looking to go public next summer. But diversifying and broadening Channel Advisor's revenue base is seen as a precursor to an IPO, and Wingo hints the company is moving in that direction by expanding globally. When we look at the economy out 5 years, the United States is only 30%, he says, of the global market, adding that to compete on an international scale, Channel Advisor is looking to expand globally. With offices in London, Australia, New York, Germany, Seattle, and Ireland, the company has a global backbone on which to build. Channel Advisor has its sights set on setting up operations in Brazil and Hong Kong, says Wingo. Jim Verdonik, a securities lawyer with Warden Smith & Raleigh, says a global presence can be appealing to investors. Being international dresses up the prospectus and makes the business seem bigger than it might actually be, he says. Channel Advisor, founded in 2001, has raised more than $75 million in venture financing. Investors include Kodiak Venture Partners, Southern Capital Ventures, New Enterprise Associates, and eBay. Of those investors, only Southern Capital Ventures partner Ben Brooks returned a request for a response, and his response was to decline comment. While the move to grow its footprint could be an attempt to boost its international presence and therefore its revenue in advance of an IPO, Wyrick Robbins securities lawyer Larry Robbins says global sales are not usually a requirement to go public. The big consideration is the finances themselves and how they would be reported, meaning a successful public company would need an experienced financial staff, Robbins says. In today's market, the buyers are not interested in an average or typical company that you might have seen go public 10 years ago, Robbins says. Now, if you have less than $50 million in revenue, you're probably not a candidate to go public unless you have a huge hockey stick trajectory where within a very short period of time, you're going to be at that level of revenue. Reuters quotes sources close to the company in reporting that Channel Advisor books revenue of about $50 million a year, putting it potentially on the cusp of the threshold mentioned by Robbins. Channel Advisor reported to Inc. for the magazine's Inc. 500 list of 2006 that it generated revenue of $3.7 million in 2003 and $18.9 million in 2006. Partially owned by eBay, Channel Advisor employs about 300. Robbins also says the company must be predictable. If your revenue, your earnings are bumpy and unpredictable, it's not going to be much fun once you get out there, he says. Hiring investment bankers is done early on the route to an IPO because of the massive amount of work required to prepare a private company for the public market. Queries made to Goldman Sachs and Stifel Nicolaus were not answered. Companies have to have a significant following in the investment banking community, or they must make themselves known because success could be determined by research reports that institutions provide to investment bankers and buyers. Those buyers are really important for most companies getting ready to go into the public market because those buyers tend to hold on to their shares longer, Robbins says. A big problem Robbins sees is companies overestimating their liquidity opportunities. For companies that have $100 million or $200 million or $300 million in market cap, going public is not really a liquidity event, it's a financing event, he says, adding that shareholders are stuck with shares in that event because there aren't enough buyers. If you have a large investor that wants liquidity and to get out of the market, that investor could create a death spiral. It's a phenomenon, Robin says, he's seen among local life science companies. Channel Advisor provides e-commerce software aimed at increasing the sales of online retailers. Clients include Speedo, Dell, Eddie Bauer, and Brookstone. And now we move down the page, on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This next article has a black border around it. Inside that, at the very top, first in bold black lettering is the headline, Eureka! Exclamation point, NCSU researchers advancing chip research. And then under that is the article, but within the article, there's a very large picture of a woman in a white lab coat holding some chemicals, wearing safety goggles and gloves. The caption reads, Sephora Sefakar says findings could ultimately result in easier, less expensive process. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Raleigh. It was a momentous occasion for NC State University PhD candidate Sephora Sefakar, and one that could someday impact the ubiquitous smartphone. It was the moment she realized she had created ceramic films at room temperature. Ceramic films are vital in the production of myriad electronics products, including smartphones and tablet computers. Prior to Sefakar's discovery, they could only be created in a temperature-controlled environment. Using a substrate or base, she applies a chemical, spins it in a machine, dries it in another machine, and viola. See, she says, demonstrating in a white lab coat, the usual process is more complicated. All such films, textured nickel ferrite ceramic thin films, or NFOs, have two significant properties. They do not conduct electricity, but they are magnetic. Sefakar's films have two other properties. They are inexpensive and, to researchers at least, they're simple to make. Boston-based Northeastern University researcher Vincent Harris is not involved in Sefakar's research, but he does research in a similar area. He currently has to use lasers to create what Sefakar makes with her chemical syringe. Think of them like ceramics, just like the plates you eat from, only they are magnetic, Harris says of the films. They're used specifically in film form in electronics that operate at very high frequencies. Because the plates are magnetic, they interact with electromagnetic waves, sending, receiving, or manipulating the waves, he says. Technology send and receive electronic signals, he says, using radar as an example. The wave is bouncing off of something and coming back. And it's all because of this material, which is a critical element in making cell phones and other electronics devices work. It's sending a signal to a base station, sending it up to a satellite, and then sending it to my phone, Harris explains, adding that there are military applications, think unmanned drones. The grain of the chemical leaves on the film is unique, lead NC State researcher Justin Schwartz says, adding that it, like the research, is difficult to understand. Magnetic domains are boundaries, he says. If you think about a map of the United States, if you look at an aerial view, you wouldn't know where North Carolina began and Virginia started. It's like that with atoms, he says, until you look at them using magnetic measurements. Then you can see the domains that that specificity is vital in magnetic storage applications. So why is NC State's new process important? Because it means that creating these materials can be done in a lab, without expensive devices such as vacuums and lasers. It would be a major advance in the fabrication of microwave integrated circuits, Harris says, pointing out that such an advance would make films more accessible to researchers such as himself, meaning smaller, lighter, and higher performance radar would be on the horizon. That would improve technologies in everything from cell phones to military drones. But there's one big problem with NC State's research. Its formula uses nickel. Most electronics are more compatible with another element, zinc. NC State's films are also too thin for most applications, he says. Sefakar says that's the next phase in the research, making the films thicker and using different elements. If that's successful, Harris says that tiny ceramic plate you probably haven't heard of could do big things for products you use every day. It could be huge, he says. The research, 3 years and counting, is being conducted jointly by NC State and Georgia Tech, utilizing a $360,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article, written by Jason DeBrun, with a dateline of Chapel Hill. The headline, in comparison, UNC Chapel Hill pay low for leader. More than a dozen major universities or systems are in the process of hiring a new president or chancellor, and every one currently pays a higher salary for the position, in some cases by a wide margin, than does UNC Chapel Hill. Take, for example, the presidency at Pennsylvania State University, a job that opened up after Graham Spanier left amid the scandal involving former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. In 2011, Spanier received more than $1 million in total compensation. By comparison, Thorpe received $420,000, the same as NC State University Chancellor Randy Woodson. They are the highest paid chancellors in the UNC system. At private colleges in North Carolina, Nito R. Cuban made $1.4 million as president of High Point University in 2009. Duke University president Richard Broadhead received compensation of $879,000. Indeed, Thorpe, Woodson, and UNC system president Tom Ross each received low compensation packages relative to a peer group identified by the UNC System Office for Institutional Research. The past president of the University of Georgia made $575,418. That doesn't necessarily mean UNC Chapel Hill won't find a qualified candidate. There are more factors to attract a candidate beyond salary, says Matthew Lambert, associate vice president for university development at Georgetown University, who closely follows the UNC system. I think that UNC Chapel Hill is a jewel, he says. You have such unquestionable support from the public for these institutions. There are only a handful of places that are as special a place as Chapel Hill. Even at lower compensation, those factors will attract good candidates, Lambert says. Even if compensation were higher, the search committee, chaired by UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees Chairman Wade Hargrove, and the Dallas, Texas-based search firm R. William Funk & Associates, would face stiff competition. Not only has there been unusually high turnover in presidential suites, but budget pressures make the job even more difficult. The 23-campus California State University system hired a new president on October 4, but not until it went through a lengthy process to find the right person for the job, says Bill Houck, a CSU trustee who led the search committee. The CSU system is separate from the University of California system, which includes universities like UC Berkeley. It's no secret that states, for the last several years, have been reducing, sometimes significantly, state resources to these universities, he says. The first challenge is to find a competent person who doesn't just look at that situation and say, it's too difficult to overcome. In addressing the search committee on October 8, System President Ross did not downplay the significance of finding the 11th chancellor for UNC Chapel Hill. There will likely be nothing you do that is as important to the University of North Carolina than the work you will do as a member of this search committee, he said. It is a time that demands that we find the best to lead this university. Hargrove says the 21-member search committee will hold public forums on campus and seek input from the university community, alumni, and the general public on the personal and professional qualities necessary for UNC Chapel Hill's next chancellor. The group held its first meeting October 4 and plans to have a chancellor in place by July 1, 2013. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Durham loses two Bank of America branches as bank slashes costs. Charlotte-based Bank of America closed 8 branch offices in North Carolina during the 12 months ending June 30, according to Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation data. That's 4% of the 196 branches closed nationwide in a cost-cutting move. Of the 8 closings, 2 were in Durham County, 3 in Mecklenburg, and 1 each in Carteret, Forsyth, and Buncombe. The FDIC data doesn't yet include Bank of America's decision to shutter a Chapel Hill office in the 100 block of East Franklin Street. Bank of America officials have said the branch closings are part of an effort to align its office footprint with the greatest customer demand. Three engineers from McKim and Creed's Raleigh office on September 14 through 15 hiked to the top of Pikes Peak to raise money and awareness for Water for People, an international nonprofit dedicated to providing access to improved water and sanitation systems and services in developing countries. Adrian Coombs, Mackenzie McBride, and Brian T. White climbed to the top of the 14,115-foot-tall Colorado Mountain as part of the 21-member Climb for Water team, which included water resources professionals from several different companies. The team exceeded its goal of raising $1 for every vertical foot climbed. "This trip really makes you appreciate how easy it is for us to get clean water whenever we need it," says Coombs, who is a business developer with McKim and Creed. McBride is an engineering intern, and White is a staff engineer. Duke University is starting to flesh out its leadership team for Duke Kunshan University in China. Duke is launching DKU in conjunction with Wuhan University in Kunshan, and that university's former president, Liu Jingnan, has been named chancellor of DKU. Mary Brown Bullock, former president of Agnes Scott College and a scholar of U.S.-China relations, has been appointed executive vice chancellor. Duke leaders have publicly given nothing but full-throated support for the project, but have delayed its opening several times. Classes are scheduled to begin in the 2014 to 2015 school year. The U.S. Supreme Court plans to hear arguments from two of North Carolina's top litigators during the annual term that began October 1. North Carolina Solicitor General John Madry and his predecessor, Christopher Browning, are scheduled to square off in January, says Browning, who now leads the appellate practice in the Raleigh office of Williams Mullen. The case involves a 12-year-old Alexander County girl who suffered permanent injuries when delivered at birth. The girl's parents filed a medical malpractice lawsuit and eventually settled for $2.8 million. The state's Medicaid program, meanwhile, had paid $1.9 million for the girl's medical treatment and tried to recoup the expense by placing a lien on the settlement. A federal appellate court ruled in March that federal law prohibits such liens, handing a win to the girl and her attorneys at the Raleigh firm Kirby and Holt. Madry's team appealed that ruling on behalf of the state, and the court agreed on September 25 to review it. Browning says he expects the nine justices to hear oral arguments, typically 30 minutes from each side, sometime in January. Boo! Beware if you venture to downtown Raleigh on the evening of October 27, the Saturday before Halloween. City Plaza will be taken over by zombies. It's what's being billed as the first annual Raleigh Living Dead Festival, featuring zombie circus street performances, a Redress the Dead fashion show, and zombie dance camp with a streetwide flash mob of Thriller. Such events have been staged in other cities for some time. Here it's being put on by two Raleigh companies, Gumption and Legacy Event Planners. The Dead will roam from 4 p.m. till 11 p.m., and the cost will be $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Local LED powerhouse Cree Incorporated is lighting up the U.S. Senate. The company has installed its lights in the Hart Senate Office Building, the third and largest office building serving the U.S. Senate. The installations are designed to last 50,000 hours or more and reduce energy consumption, minimizing operational costs. The luminaires replaced 130 CFL downlights and linear fluorescents throughout the Hart building. Now open in Durham's Five Points is Pizzeria Toro, featuring pizzas cooked in a wood-fired oven. Besides pizza, offerings include antipasta, select artisan hams, including imported prosciuttos, salads, and house-made desserts. "We start with really great ingredients and then try to stay out of the way and not screw them up," says chef and owner Gary Brooks. Pizzeria Toro marks a return to Durham for Brooks, who grew up in the Bull City and worked at several area restaurants, including Pepper's Pizza and Crook's Corner, before moving to Seattle, where he worked under Tom Douglas, the 2012 James Beard Restaurateur of the Year, for 12 years. Friends of Historic Moorfields in Hillsborough will host a fundraiser and early evening dinner on the lawn of the home on October 14 to raise money toward its preservation. It's $100 a ticket and begins at 4 p.m. Moorfields was built in 1785 as a summer home by Alfred Moor, a military and educational leader and prominent jurist who ultimately served as the second and last North Carolinian on the United States Supreme Court. In 1949, the home was sold to Edward Thayer Draper Savage, a UNC Chapel Hill French professor and artist who laid out formal gardens in the French style and extensively restored and preserved the house. He died in 1978 and is buried west of the house with his cats. Today, the entire property is maintained as a wildlife refuge and community resource abutting Orange County's 300-acre Seven Mile Creek Nature Preserve. The Margulies family, owners of United Restaurant Equipment in Raleigh, have bought National Power Corporation's old headquarters building at 5100 Departure Drive and plan to use it as a showplace for the company's products. Margu Fam LLC, led by United Restaurant Equipment owner Howard Margulies, paid $1.2 million for the building and an adjacent lot for future expansion, according to Wake County records. Executives at the former Stewart Engineering and Hayden Stansdale say the best decision they made was to not put a timeline on their merger. That allowed them flexibility when more time was needed, such as when they tweaked the deal to satisfy regulators. The new company goes simply by the name Stewart. It has 115 employees and has its main headquarters on Fayetteville Street in Raleigh. Stewart Engineering brought revenue in the $10 million range to the table, and Hayden Stansdale had about $2 million. Those were down from peak years of $14 million for Stewart Engineering and $4.5 million for Hayden Stansdale, marks that leaders of the company say they should hit again in the near future as a combined entity. The merger closed September 15th, and there have not been layoffs to date. Succession planning is a task often overlooked by technology executives. A report by Robert Half Technology states, the survey finds 79% of chief information officers haven't identified a successor in the event they have to leave the company. And contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Bagley, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Jason DeBrun, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Thomas Linderman Graham Sell Firm. And along with this article, there is a picture of a man in suit and tie standing in front of a sign in front of a brick wall. The caption reads, John Linderman shows the new brand, Avison Young. Rex Thomas, Jack Graham, Thomas Linderman, and five other principals are taking their exit with the sale of their commercial real estate firm to Avison Young, a fast-growing Toronto company. Gone will be a 14-year affiliation with the national Grubb & Ellis company, as will the old name, Grubb & Ellis, Thomas Linderman Graham. The company will operate as Avison Young. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed, but John Linderman, president and COO of Thomas Linderman Graham, says the deal will likely have little impact on the company's local property management and brokerage activities. We wanted to protect the family we've built, says Linderman, who will be managing director of the Avison Young office in Raleigh when the acquisition is complete by the end of October. Thomas, who handed over most leadership duties to Linderman several years ago, will have no leadership duties with Avison Young, but will remain as a transactional professional. Graham will oversee administrative functions for the office. The yellow and black Grubb & Ellis signs, posted in more than 120 commercial buildings across the region, will soon be gone, replaced with the red, white, and blue signs of Avison Young. The change marks the end of an era for Grubb & Ellis, Thomas Linderman Graham, one of the largest commercial real estate companies in the Triangle and one of the oldest and largest affiliates in the Grubb & Ellis affiliate program that at one time had more than 50 members. But it also marks a new beginning for the 8 owners and principals of the Raleigh Company, founded 13 years ago when local real estate veterans Rex Thomas and John Linderman merged their firms. They added Graham's name to the company when they merged with his Chapel Hill firm in 2004. Thomas Graham and the 60 brokers and staff members at the firm's offices in Raleigh and in Chapel Hill are also expected to remain with the firm. Thomas Linderman Graham remained loyal to Grubb and Ellis, Linderman says, even in the midst of financial difficulties that culminated in Grubb and Ellis, at one time a global top 20 firm, filing for bankruptcy protection. BGC Partners took ownership of the remaining Grubb and Ellis assets in March, but that did not include any ownership in Thomas Linderman Graham. The Raleigh firm, which was honored as Grubb and Ellis' Affiliate of the Year in 2009, was heavily courted by BGC to stay, Linderman says, but their terms and conditions didn't work for us. BGC has since combined its assets from Grubb and Ellis Company and its Newmark and Company Real Estate Incorporated Company into one real estate brand, Newmark Grubb Knight Frank, which so far has no office in the Triangle region. It does have an office in Charlotte. In the Triangle region, Thomas Linderman Graham provides property management services for more than 3.4 million square feet of office, flex, warehouse, and retail properties. It also provides leasing and other brokerage services for about 5 million square feet of companies, 5 million square feet of properties. Linderman says that once the decision was made to leave Grubb and Ellis, his team did a cost-benefit analysis of just about every national and international real estate firm to find the best fit. Under the Avis and Young model, the 8 principals from the Triangle area offices will become shareholders of the independently owned Avis and Young international firm. The transition was made easier, he says, knowing that the chairman and chief executive of Avis and Young is Mark Rose, formerly a top executive with Grubb and Ellis, with whom they had worked before. They are not this flashy whiz-bang firm, but their culture and their plan fits with us, he says. Rose, in a news release about acquisition, stated that Thomas Linderman Graham's senior talent would enable the company to expand its presence across all of North Carolina. Thomas Linderman Graham is very well respected and a true market leader in the growing Raleigh-Durham market. We couldn't be more pleased to have this team on board, Rose said. One of the biggest casualties of the merger will be the loss of the brand and name recognition that Grubb and Ellis brought to the table, says Scott Burkhead, managing partner of Burkhead Brand Group in Cary. The Grubb and Ellis name has been around for a long time, but if they are clever about it, they can establish this new name in a fresh way in a market they know well, Burkhead says. There will be some pain in the transition because you can't just walk away from a name that has been your umbrella for years. In the past year, Avis & Young has been expanding its presence in the United States using a $40 million private equity investment to acquire offices or hire away a number of former Grubb & Ellis staff in several major markets, including in Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and San Francisco. BGC Partners filed a lawsuit against Avis & Young in August, alleging that it had illegally looted business from Grubb & Ellis, including poaching Grubb & Ellis affiliates in South Carolina and Nevada. The Thomas Linderman Graham affiliate was not named in the lawsuit. With the acquisition of Thomas Linderman Graham, Avis & Young has grown in the past 3 years from 11 offices to 40 offices in 33 markets in Canada and the U.S. And our next article is a little lower down on the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border, the background is olive. At the very top, there's a picture of a man sitting in a chair next to a nurse with his sleeve rolled up. The caption reads, UNC's Vice Chancellor Richard Mann gets a flu shot from nurse Fran Whitfield at UNC hospitals. Then under that in bold black lettering is the headline, Closest in Care, Duke Leads in Ratio of Nurses to Patients. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Durham. The Duke University Health System employs more nurses per licensed bed than the two other health systems in the Triangle. And while too many factors are involved to draw a singular cause and effect, It is notable that Duke ranks highest among the three in U.S. News & World Report's ranking of best hospitals. At its hospitals, DUHS has 4,650 nurses on staff, or 3.1 per licensed bed. The UNC healthcare hospitals employ 4,384 nurses, or 2.9 per licensed bed, and WakeMed Health and Hospitals counts 2,427 nurses on its roster, or 2.8 per licensed bed. In addition, Duke has fewer patient days and fewer patient discharges per nurse. U.S. News & World Report annually ranks the nation's top hospitals based on research that includes a survey of nearly 10,000 specialists and data from approximately 5,000 hospitals. The magazine considers the balance of nurses and patients among its criteria. In the most recent listing, DUMC is ranked the best hospital in the state, with UNC hospitals in Chapel Hill third, Durham Regional and Duke Raleigh, both part of DUHS, ranked fifth and 15th, respectively. Rex Healthcare, part of the UNC Healthcare, ranks eighth, and WakeMed ranks 20th in the state. When budgeting for nurse staffing, chief nursing officers use a somewhat straightforward formula. At Duke, the formula considers how many and what kind of patients the hospital expects in a year, divided by how many hours a full-time nurse will be on the floor to arrive at the number of budgeted nurses per year, says Mary Ann Fuchs, DUHS Chief Nurse Executive. Of course, patients never arrive at the hospital in budgeted ways, so all hospitals must be flexible, but Fuchs hopes to hit that budgeted number fairly closely by the end of the year. It's not a pure science, agrees Mary Lou Powell, Chief Nursing Officer at Rex Healthcare, but there are metrics that we use. Powell gets a weekly report that shows how many hours of care each patient receives. The recommended hours of care depends on the acuity of the patient, of course, but it allows Powell to track the performance of the nursing staff. Formulas don't bring outcomes, though, says Carla Lugerio, Senior Associate Director of Federal Relations at the American Hospital Association. When thinking about nurse staffing, you don't want a cookie-cutter approach, she says. You have to approach it with flexibility. Advances in technology also help. With various kinds of electronic monitoring, nurses can keep a very close eye on patients, even if not directly bedside. Also, different hospitals see different kinds of patients. The average length of stay at UNC hospitals was 6.1 days, and at Duke was 5.8 days in 2011, meaning patients likely had more serious procedures that required longer recoveries. The average stay at Rex Healthcare, by contrast, was 3.9 days. There are so many different types of hospitals, Lugerio says. The appropriate amount of help can play a role, especially when nurses need equipment, says Rex's Powell. Take an intravenous pump, for example. Most patients require one, and if a nurse must spend time looking for that piece of equipment, that's time away from the patient. If a nurse assistant could instead do that work, it would allow the nurse to spend more time with the patient. I don't think you can just look at nurse staffing, she says. Simply increasing nurse staffing doesn't necessarily translate to better outcomes. In 2004, California legislation increased nurse-to-patient ratios, and researchers saw this as a perfect opportunity to measure outcomes compared with other states. Barbara Mark, a professor at the UNC School of Nursing, led a study that found some improvements in a few areas, but there were other areas where health outcomes were no better than at hospitals in other states that did not mandate staffing levels. The study was published in Health Services Research. Goodwin heads up task force on workers wrongly classified. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. A special task force looking to combat the practice of employee misclassification in North Carolina will study the records of a handful of other states that have tried to clamp down on the problem. Misclassification happens when an employer classifies a full-time worker as an independent contractor to avoid paying workers' compensation premiums, payroll withholding taxes, overtime, and other benefits. Governor Beverly Perdue set up the 16-member group, chaired by Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin, in August, giving it the authority to recommend any new laws it deems necessary to curb the practice. The group, which held its first meeting in September, could make those recommendations to the 2013 General Assembly. In the meantime, Goodwin has asked various task force members to contact representatives of Ohio, Florida, Texas, and New York to find out how officials there coordinate communications among state agencies, including the sharing of database information, to spot offenders. Please identify any barriers that you believe may inhibit your agency's ability to share information and, most importantly, proposed actions to overcome those barriers, Goodwin wrote in an October 3 letter to task force members. On the North Carolina task force are the secretaries of all of the major state departments, including Revenue, Public Safety, Commerce, as well as State Attorney General Roy Cooper, Industrial Commission Chair Pamela Young, and North Carolina Sheriff's Association President Tony Perry. The upshot of employee misclassification is at least twofold. Workers are left without adequate insurance coverage if they are injured on the job, while governments see less tax revenue coming into their coffers. In recent years, it's been the construction industry in Texas that has come under misclassification scrutiny. In New York, it is the restaurant industry. Not available at this point are any estimates concerning how widespread the problem is in North Carolina. There is a general acknowledgement that it is occurring, says Department of Insurance spokeswoman Carrie Hall. One federal study completed all the way back in 1984 concluded that up to 15% of employers were misclassifying workers then. Ray Evans, a task force member and general manager of the North Carolina Rate Bureau, an insurance industry group, says that despite the age of the 1984 study, the number is probably still operative. There's nothing to suggest that it has changed much, he says. About the only other hard number on the issue, also national, comes from a 2006 study by the Government Accountability Office, GAO. According to David Graham of the Insurance Journal, GAO was estimating that misclassification was costing the government about $3 billion a year in various tax underpayments. Estimated state-level underpayments were not available. The renewed interest in what's an old problem stems from the recession and whether in the face of hard times, more employers have started resorting to the practice to cut costs. Since 2011, the U.S. Department of Labor has been making an issue of the practice. The task force is required to submit progress reports every 6 months. Its first report, due in early 2013, will wind up on the desk of Purdue's successor, either Walter Dalton or Pat McCrory. And our next article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dayline of Research Triangle Park. The headline, Syngenta Product Instruction Cited in Corn Crop Losses. Company's lawyer denies allegation being made in case that follows bankruptcy of North Carolina Farm. And also, with this article, there is a large picture of a cornfield, and the caption reads, Lawyer says farmers' corn didn't achieve acceptable growth, such as is shown in the photo. And the photo shows a full-grown corn. Fallout from the implosion of one of northeastern North Carolina's largest farms is hitting Syngenta Corporation, with the farm's bankruptcy trustees alleging that bad advice from a Syngenta salesman caused a corn crop to be stunted. James Winslow and his family had farmed in the area for generations, and Winslow's company, Tanglewood Farms Incorporated, grew wheat, corn, and soybeans over thousands of acres, including a large swath of corn in Carteret County. Tanglewood is liquidating in bankruptcy. In a lawsuit filed in mid-August, trustees Richard Sparkman and James Angel sued Syngenta, alleging that Winslow's 2009 corn crop was stunted because he applied the Syngenta fungicide, Quilt, too early in the growing season after following the advice of Syngenta salesman Kurt Whitehead. Trustees are court-designated attorneys who manage and sell a company's assets in bankruptcy. They can sue third parties who dealt with the company to recover assets that are due to creditors. Sparkman's and Angel's lawsuit doesn't put a dollar value on the loss of the crop in Carteret County, and Angel declined to do so in an interview. The bankruptcy petition that Tanglewood filed in 2010 put a value of at least $38.3 million on its liabilities. About 4,000 acres of land and various pieces of farm equipment that it owned were auctioned away in Elizabeth City in March 2011 for $17 million. Winslow, meanwhile, has pleaded guilty to charges that he sold some $7 million of grain that he was storing for another farmer. He was sentenced in June to a year of house arrest and continues to farm in Pasquotank County. Through its Raleigh attorney, Jamie Dean of Womble Carlisle, Syngenta flatly denies that Whitehead's advice was responsible for the crop failure. Dean also argues that Quilt's marketing and Whitehead's statements don't add up to a warranty on the product, as the plaintiffs allege. Syngenta representatives couldn't be reached for comment. Basel, Switzerland-based Syngenta is one of five large companies in and around Research Triangle Park that develop chemicals and biotechnology for the agriculture industry. Syngenta, Bayer Crop Science, Monsanto, BASF Plant Science, and DuPont Pioneer are five of the six largest companies in the industry. The lawsuit says two agricultural scientists and the Pasquotank County Cooperative Extension Service looked into the crop failure and concluded that applying the fungicide in June, as Tanglewood did, was too early. North Carolina State University pesticide expert Wayne Bueller says it's sometimes important to apply a fungicide relatively early in the growing season to prevent fungi from establishing themselves, but he adds that labels on most products specify when they should be applied. It's very difficult to kill fungi once they become established, Bueller says. NC State crop scientist Stephen Koning adds that it's a bit unusual for a fungicide to stunt crop's growth. Koning adds that he's seen at least one crop harm because farm workers failed to wash herbicide residue out of the spraying tank before filling it with pesticide or fungicide. Energy leaders seeking clarity on alternatives. That's the headline of this article written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Charlotte. Alternative energy companies say they're holding back on hiring and investing as large question marks loom over policy directions at the state and national levels. The industry is still expanding a bit more strongly than most others in the sluggish economy, but its growth slowed dramatically this year. Democratic and Republican candidates are putting forth starkly different policies on alternative energy and in the presidential, gubernatorial, and legislative elections that loom in November. The elections are a much more pressing factor than they were in 2011, industry researcher Rich Crowley says. There are also growing questions about state tax credits and minimum quotas for utilities' use of alternative energy. Crowley says in a report that the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association released at its annual meeting on October 11 in Charlotte. All types of business owners need to know what the rules are so they can plan for a considerable period of time, says Crowley, lead author of the group's annual Clean Energy Industry Census. The census determined that the equivalent of 15,300 full-time workers or full-time employees work at those companies in North Carolina, ranging from solar panel installers to developers of software for electricity management and builders that focus on weatherizing homes for energy efficiency. The employment number was up 3% from 2011, following 10% growth that the group reported last year. The Triangle has the state's largest concentration of such companies. Nearly half of the 1,100 alternative energy companies in the state have at least one location here, according to the census. Crowley says dozens of the companies reported political and regulatory uncertainty as a prime reason for holding off on some hiring and investment decisions. Current incentives include a tax credit for solar panels. In North Carolina, utilities must meet an escalating series of minimum quotas for deriving electricity from solar energy and other renewable fuels. Those include relatively small quotas for solar energy and swine and poultry waste. State Representative Mike Hager, who chairs the House Committee on Public Utilities, says it might be better to eliminate those quotas so that utilities can choose from a broader range of alternative energies. A Republican running for re-election in heavily Republican Rutherford County, Hager says he aims to assemble a group of Republicans and Democrats to study the issue and possibly introduce legislation in the first few weeks of the 2013 legislative session. Hager says surcharges associated with the quote add $5 to $6 to his monthly electricity bill. Similar charges on other customers' bills add up to millions of dollars that could be invested, Hager says. Some companies are also jittery following the July 2012 merger of Duke Energy Corporation with Progress Energy Incorporated and the subsequent departure of CEO Bill Johnson, Crowley says, because the two utilities have taken different approaches to procuring alternative energy. Marcus Wilhelm, CEO of Strata Solar in Chapel Hill, says uncertainty hasn't kept his company from growing. It employs between 300 and 400 people, depending on the mix of projects that are going on in any one given week. But Wilhelm notes that he's planning around a solar panel tax credit lasting until 2016. While a phase-out after that wouldn't be a huge shock, a sudden elimination would be, he says. The worst thing would be a surprise, Wilhelm says. And our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dayline of Raleigh. The headline, Some Banks Selling Cheap Based on Their Book Value. And along with this article, there's a man in a tie standing in front of a window where you can look out the window and see a large landscape, the highway. The caption reads, Scott Custer Engineered Purchase of ECB. In the banking industry, it's still a buyer's market. Just ask veteran Raleigh bankers Scott Custer and Michael Patterson. Both are expansion-minded businessmen whose latest acquisitions can only be characterized as sweet deals based on data compiled by Atlanta-based Bank Street Partners. Custer, busy building a statewide community banking organization, paid 65.4% of tangible book value for Engelhard-based East Carolina Bank, ECB. Meanwhile, Patterson, intent on adding branch offices to his Raleigh-based business bank, Capstone, paid 66.4% for a Fuquay-based Patriot State Bank. Both are well under the 76% of book value median price shelled out in all North Carolina bank deals in the 12 months ending October 1, says Bank Street's Lee Burrows. Tangible book value is a measure of a company's total assets minus items such as goodwill. The 66% is hardly a fire sale price, given the sinking valuations attached to some troubled banks in recent years. Neither ECB nor Patriot were in that category. In fact, unless it's an all-cash deal, it's hard to say what a fire sale price would be, says Burrows. Banking analyst Don Coker agrees. The quality of the assets being bought has a lot to do with it, he says. I've seen some banks with a negative value. Data on the Triangle's third most recent deal, the sale by Four Oaks Bank of its Southern Pines and Rockingham branches to First Bank of Troy, are not yet available. One factor pushing the transactions were the challenges faced by all three sellers in raising new cash. It was after the unraveling of an $80 million private placement fundraiser that ECB CEO Dwight Utz began looking at his options. We provided the ECB board with an analysis of what the future looked like, he said in a recent interview. We knew we'd have to do a capital raise dilutive to shareholders in the next several months. Instead, a merger into Custer's growing bank footprint seemed a better way to go, he said. Add to the industry's fundraising challenge another matter, namely that community banks now face higher costs to fund their loans, higher in many cases than the funding costs faced by the larger banks. It all adds up to a prescription for more bank consolidation in the coming months, and I think we will see a lot of it in the industry, says Burrows. Now we turn to the opinion page in the Triangle Business Journal, and this is a guest column from Brian Balfour. And once again, it is on the opinion page. The headline, Time to Scrap North Carolina Income Tax. North Carolina legislators will take a serious crack at reforming the state's tax code in 2013. This raises a question. What tax structure will impose the least destruction on the state's economy and enable it to become competitive? Economists have researched the topic and largely have formed a consensus. Income taxes cause more harm to a state's economy than sales taxes. In a book published by the American Legislative Exchange Council, Rich States, Poor States, former Ronald Reagan economic advisor Arthur Laffer declares, states that wish to increase growth would best do so by eliminating or lowering their corporate and personal income tax rates. The book examines 11 states that enacted a personal income tax in the last 50 years. Without exception, all the states have a smaller share of the nation's economy than they did before the enactment of an income tax. University of Colorado economist Barry Paulson ran a regression analysis of state economic performance and concluded, the analysis underscores the negative impact of income taxes on economic growth in the states. States relying on income taxes for revenue experience slower economic growth than those relying on other taxes. In a 2001 paper, Ohio University economist Richard Vedder compared the performance of states from 1957 to 1997 and found a strong negative relationship between income taxes and economic growth. Sales taxes are clearly less harmful than income taxes, he wrote. And for those who insist that corporations must pay their fair share of taxes, you may want to consider where the tax burden falls. An examination of state data from 1977 to 2005 prompted a Federal Reserve economist to conclude labor bears a significant burden from state corporate income tax in the form of lower wages. In a globalized world, North Carolina tax policy also should consider foreign direct investment, which constitutes a growing share of the U.S. economy. A 2001 paper written by University of Michigan economists found, for foreign investors, the corporate tax rate is the most relevant tax in their investment decision. Other research finds benefits to states that rely more heavily on sales tax than income tax. Revenue generated from sales taxes is the least affected by the boom and bust cycle. In fact, sales tax revenue changes by only half as much as revenue from personal and corporate income taxes, Laffer found. It's no coincidence that North Carolina, with its over-reliance on personal and corporate income taxes, is suffering from the fifth highest unemployment rate in the nation. It has seen per capita income drop below the national and regional averages during the past decade. Our tax structure is set up exactly opposite to what theory and evidence tells us we should do. Eliminating personal and corporate income taxes would be the boldest and wisest move to make North Carolina competitive again. Imagine every worker receiving a raise in take-home pay and businesses small and large no longer burdened with punishing tax bills. To replace the lost revenue, North Carolina could expand the sales tax to include services and likely would need to raise the rate slightly. The modern economy is much more service-oriented, and this new tax code would better reflect that. The bottom line? Such a reform would promote job and income growth and provide a more stable source of revenue to state government. And that was a guest column from Brian Balfour on the opinion page. And with our remaining minutes, we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. DHHS receives $5.6 million grant. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has received a three-year, $5.6 million grant for programs that support people with HIV. Some of the money will be used to engage community-based organizations and support activities designed to encourage more HIV testing for at-risk populations and link HIV-positive patients into care. The award was made by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention under the New Care and Prevention in the U.S., or CAPPIS, demonstration project. North Carolina is one of eight states chosen to receive the federal funding. A 2011 study by UNC Chapel Hill found that treating HIV-infected individuals with antiretroviral therapy, when their immune systems are still relatively healthy, leads to a 96% reduction in HIV transmission to their partners. The study suggests that early treatment of infected individuals can have a major impact on the spread of HIV disease. Cisco severs ties with China's ZTE. Cisco Systems has ended a long-standing partnership with ZTE Corporation over allegations that the Chinese company sold its networking gear to Iran. Reuters reports that ZTE had sold banned computer equipment from Cisco and other companies to Iran's largest telecom firm. The U.S. House of Representatives Intelligence Committee is asking that ZTE and fellow Chinese telecom equipment maker Huawei Technologies be shut out of the U.S. market. Both Chinese companies are denying the allegations, and ZTE says it's communicating with Cisco to resolve the situation. Cisco and ZTE have been partnering for about 7 years. Wake County bankruptcy filings drop 13%. Bankruptcy activity in Wake County continued to slow in September as a fitfully recovering economy pushed fewer debtors to seek relief from their creditors. A total of 189 businesses, individuals, and households in the county filed initial petitions last month, down 13% from September 2011, according to statistics compiled by the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. Monthly counts have been trending downward since mid-2010. As in most months, the vast majority of September's bankruptcy filings were by consumers. CEO turnover down in September. Turnover among the nation's chief executive officers declined in September as 95 CEOs, including one in the Triangle, announced their departures during the month, according to a report from global outplacement firm Challenger, Gary, and Christmas, Incorporated. September CEO departures were down 8.7% from 104 in August. Last month's total was 12% lower than the corresponding month a year ago, when 108 CEO changes were recorded, Challenger said. Identity of Appia's new investor no longer a mystery. Appia CEO Judd Bowman says his company's recent $1.5 million financing round is one of the first investments of New York-based The Social Internet Fund, a project from Kerner, who is well known in tech-related finance circles. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.